Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I'm going to tell you about a paper I wrote with my advisor, Rafael Busseau, and Ben Chandrasekharan, who is another grad student at Berkeley. So this work is about trying to understand the entropy of black holes. So to begin, I'm going to actually give you a relatively long background discussion so I can properly set up the problem, the specific problem I'm interested in asking, and then tell you how we solved it. So the idea that black holes have entropies equal to their area divided by 4GH bar has been around for a long time. It dominated a lot of research in quantum gravity. And maybe one of the early evidence for this was the fact that event horizons of black holes have satisfy a first law. This is by Hawking and some other people, where basically the amount of entropy or charge or spin that you feed in the black hole sort of increases its area exactly in an analogous way to the laws of thermodynamics, except area entropy is replaced by area over 4GH bar. G is the Newton's constant. So this is 1/4 of the area measured in Planck units. And maybe more importantly for this discussion, Hawking showed that event horizon. So let me actually explain this picture a little bit. This is an asymptotically ADS space with some blue stuff collapsing into a black hole. So if I have this entire Penrose diagram, I get to draw this causal horizon, this null hypersurface, that basically tells me the points in this diagram that are doomed from exiting. Since light rays propagate at 45 degrees in Penrose diagrams, all the points in this region will inevitably end up in the singularity. So given a diagram like this with an event horizon, Hawking showed that the area of various cuts of this event horizon, so if I cut the event horizon of various slices, I get a co-dimension 2 surface, and I have an area, and Hawking showed that the area can never decrease as I move to the future of my event horizon. So that's very reminiscent of a second law that black holes seem to satisfy, second law of thermodynamics. And that, along with the discovery of Hawking radiation, that really made the idea that black holes are entropic objects with some should be thought of as some object sitting in space-time where you have to assign some sort of thermodynamic entropy to them, made it a really concrete idea that you should maybe take it really seriously. But there is a conceptual problem with assigning an entropy to black holes defined by cuts of event horizons. And the conceptual problem is that event horizons are highly teleological. I need to know the entire future of my entire history of my system to be able to tell, to be able to draw this event horizon. If a shell is going to collapse in this room in 3 minutes and form a black hole, about now, maybe a sphere with the event horizon will basically emanate from the middle of this room in form of a sphere that just expands out at the speed of light in anticipation of that shell. We would be doomed, we just don't know it yet because no local data shows that. So that's why people were motivated to define a more local definition of a black hole. This more local definition requires a concept of an expansion parameter in geometry, which I'm going to define. So basically, the expansion is, okay, given any co-dimension 2 surface in your spacetime, I can look at how the area of this surface varies as I move the surface in various directions. And my directions of interest within this talk are going to be the two orthogonal node directions to my surface. In this case, this is a green sphere-looking thing here. So and K and L are the outgoing and ingoing null directions corresponding to this surface. And the expansion in the K direction, let's say, is just how much the area of this surface will change if I move the surface a little bit in the K direction. So the amount of area change depends on the ambient geometry. In this room, gravity is very weak, so the expansion, the outgoing expansion of spheres are positive. The ingoing expansion of spheres are negative, very intuitively. But if gravity is very strong, for example, if I'm very close to this concentrated shell here that's forming a black hole, then even a sphere over here, so this diagram sphere is like every point represents a sphere. A point over there, there's so much, the gravity is so strong there that even if I try to move in the k direction, outward direction from my sphere, my areas still decrease. That would be an example of me being doomed, and I can actually tell this time. It's a local data that I can determine just by looking at space-time around this neighborhood that tells me, even in trying to escape, I can't get my area to enlarge. So this motivated the definition of a surface of the black hole as a surface, as a sphere large enough such that the expansion in the outgoing direction is actually zero. So I'm momentarily stuck. So you can do this on every slice and mark every point as like where my black hole starts. And by the way, these surfaces are called marginally trapped surfaces. So where theta k is equal to zero and theta l, as it is in this room, theta l is still negative. So if I try to go inwards, my area will decrease. And the focusing parameter is actually very useful in GR because it satisfies the Ray-Chaudhuri equation, which looks like this. And each term in this expansion, assuming the null energy condition in classical field theory, which is roughly the statement that matter is attractive in terms of its effect on gravity. The Ray-Chaudhuri equation just tells me that the rate of change of expansion as I go in the k direction is negative, which sort of roughly means that surfaces will do this. They never do this. So that's classical focusing theorem, and that's what Hawking used to actually show the area theorem, this area theorem. Okay, so this is a local notion of a black hole, so maybe it's more motivating to take the area of this local notion of a black hole seriously as an entropy, as a thermodynamic entropy. And indeed, we can show, so these are called dynamical horizons. If I define my sort of horizon as like a surface foliated by these marginally trapped surfaces. So all these green spheres are marginally trapped surfaces, and I can bundle them up together. And you can actually show that the area of these spheres also grows in time. They also, I think, satisfy an equivalent of a first law. So this is, again, a perfect candidate to, this area is a perfect candidate to have an, to interpret as some sort of thermodynamic entropy, because it satisfies all the criteria as before. So can we actually think of, so what kind of entropy is the area of a black hole? So the kind of entropy that satisfies the second law is a thermodynamic entropy or a coarse grain entropy. So we are familiar from thermodynamics courses that if you have a box of gas, even if it's in a pure state, so its density matrix is actually, has von Neumann entropy zero because you know the exact state, you could still assign to that box of gas a thermodynamic entropy. And the way you do this is you hold some certain very coarse grained data fixed, like the volume of the box, the number of particles in the box, and the energy of the box of gas. And then you maximize your ignorance about the rest of the details of the system. So you basically come up with a system with the largest von Neumann entropy possible with those fixed coarse degrees of freedom. So could we think of the area of a black hole, area over 4 GH bar of a black hole, as coarse grain entropy in that exact sense? So this is a question that Neda Engelhard and Aaron Wall asked and found a very beautiful answer to that I'm going to review. So their method, so as I discussed with the box of gas, we need some sort of microscopic theory that gives us microstates that we can count and say, well, all the microstates consistent with this particular coarse data, I'm going to, you know, add them up and compute the log of the number of microstates. This is a kind of von Neumann entropy, and that gives me the thermodynamic entropy. So what's their So basically, I need a microscopic theory and a prescription for coarse graining. Which data I want to hold fixed, like volume, number of particles. What is that for the case of a black hole? So Aaron and Neda used ADS-CFD, basically used the boundary dual of the bulk quantum gravity theory in asymptotically ADS as their microscopic theory. The CFD was the microscopic theory that the bulk emerged from. And they came up with this coarse graining prescription. Given a geometry like this, the data that I want to hold fixed is the region outside of my marginal detract surface. So in this case, the causal domain of that region would be something like this. This is called the outer wedge to that marginally trapped surface mu. So I want to hold this data fixed, and I'm going to find a state with the maximum possible von Neumann entropy subject to holding this wedge fixed. So the nice thing here is that in ADS-CFT, we have a very easy prescription for computing von Neumann entropies. But Neumann entropies are just equal to classic, at the classical level, they're just equal to area of the areas of extremal surfaces in the bulk divided by 4G H bar. So if in this geometry there's an extremal surface, I pick its area divided by 4G H bar, and that gives me the von Neumann entropy. So in this geometry, where I know everything about what was behind this, the only extremal surface here is the empty surface, and the entropy is zero. So this is where I haven't coarse grained yet. But if I do this, if I hold this wedge fixed and try to find this, the biggest area of the extremal surface, the geometry that I can put behind this is consistent with this outer wedge that has the largest area of the of an extremal surface in it, then the area of that surface would be the coarse area of that surface divided by 4 GH bar would be the coarse grain entropy in the exact sense that a coarse graining of a box of gas works. So extremal surface means theta k as well as theta l is zero. So in both directions, I'm stuck momentarily. So here's basically the prescription. Maximize area of some extremal surface x subject to holding the outer wedge fixed. If that's the case, then coarse grain entropy of this slice mu with the coarse data being the outer wedge is equal to area over 4 GH bar of the putative extremal surface. So you can actually show, yeah.
When you say holding fixed, do you have in mind like a canonical ensemble or like a microcanonical? Like, are you saying it's an eigenstate of geometry or the expectation value?
I'm thinking of it as a purely classical problem here. So classical geometry means that, you know, somehow gravity is, you think of it as, I don't know, as a geometry as some sort of like coherent state of whatever, gravitons or something, the expectation value of the metric is some value with very small fluctuations.
Okay, so you're saying it doesn't matter.
The fluctuations don't enter this because I'm not working at that level of accuracy.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk about the quantum version of this where quantum effects come in. There may be more important things there with regards to what you were asking. So, relatively easily by just using classical focusing theorem that I explained before, which follows from the null energy condition, you can show that if you have any geometry with this outer wedge, any geometry that has some extremal surface in it, the area of that extremal surface will definitely be smaller than the area of my marginally trapped surface. This is roughly the way it works is that you first sort of get to the extremal surface, no matter where it is, in a two-step process from the marginally trapped surface mu, and using classical focusing and other assumptions that follow from non-energy condition, you know that in each step you'd only lose area. So the area of any extremal surface will have to be less than area of the marginally trapped surface. So the point would be if the coarse grain entropy is equal to the area, if the coarse grain entropy of mu is actually equal to the area of the marginally trapped surface, which is sort of what I want it to be, because I want to think of the area of the marginally trapped surface as a coarse graining entropy, then I should be able to saturate this inequality. And this is exactly what their construction does. Their construction takes an outer wedge like this. So you have a surface mu here, and then you have a future null surface n plus k that emanates in the k direction from this. Here I'm showing the surface, I'm decompactifying the sphere and showing it like that. There's a green slice that this is this sphere, and then there's the n plus k. And then in the n minus k, in the negative k direction, they just attach a stationary null hypersurface. So they're thinking of this problem as a null initial value problem in GR. You have this wedge, which you can, this kind of doesn't work, I'm going to switch to this. So they have this wedge, which is fixed, and so which means that I have data on this null slice, and if I give data on this null slice, and if the data is consistent with the constraint equations of GR, then I have a solution. And if I on this surface, I can give you an extremal surface that has the same area as the marginally trapped surface, then I'm done, because I've given you initial data, and you can, if you choose, you can evolve it back and forth in time and see what the entire geometry is, but you don't have to. This is it. This is a solution. And the way that the extremal surface is, shows up is that if you attach a stationary null surface behind my marginally trapped surface mu in the negative k direction, by definition of the surface being stationary, my expansion, so the expansion between these leaves as I move up and down this n minus k, is zero, and also its shear is zero. Shear is a different parameter where, so if expansion is about areas getting larger or smaller, shear is about surface doing this or that. Like the area is fixed, but it's getting sort of going from a sphere to an ellipse or something. So a null stationary surface would have to have shear also equal to zero, because these geometries of these foliations are going to be exactly the same. So by attaching such a surface behind mu, they manage to keep theta k and therefore the area of the surface mu constant as they move down. And the interesting thing is that the derivative of the in the k direction of theta l, so expansion off of this surface, in a stationary surface, on a stationary n minus k, will be a negative constant, which means that if I move in a negative k direction, theta l is going to linearly increase. So it's going to go from the negative value it had here, eventually at some finite affine parameter, to zero. So you mark that as your extremal surface, because it's theta k as well as theta l is zero. And because you held theta k zero along this path, the area of that extremal surface is equal to the area of that surface mu. So now, they were able to show that the coarse grain entropy, in the precise sense of holding the outer wedge fixed while maximizing the von Neumann entropy, is actually equal to the area of this surface. So thinking about, so black hole entropy is the coarse grain entropy in the precise sense. Okay. So this was all classical. The problem starts when you include quantum effects. So quantum effects basically violate, you know, quantum mechanically we can have negative energy, which means that the null energy condition, which was a fundamental assumption in deriving all these area theorems in GR, is violated. So if area law is violated, so for example, you can imagine an example of a process that violates the area law of event horizons or black holes is just Hawking evaporation. The black hole shrinks all the way down to zero areas, you know, so you lose area law by a lot because of quantum effects. So you might think, well, we're done, this area law things don't work, but an interesting development has been that, you know, see, then this idea has also existed for a long time, and it's sort of coming back in a resurgence in recent years, where you, if you take the area of a surface, of a codimension 2 surface, and add the von Neumann entropy of the matter fields outside of this surface to it in this way, so you add area over 4 GH bar plus entropy of outside, you can formulate a quantity called the generalized entropy. This was first introduced by Bekenstein, but maybe not in this specific form. And when you construct this quantity, generalized entropy, it looks like any time there is a theorem about areas in classical gravity, if you replace the area over 4 GH bar by generalized entropy, it upholds again. I mean, it's not going to be every instance maybe, but in many interesting cases. So for example, the area law of causal horizons is violated by Hawking evaporation, but the entropy production outside of a black hole due to Hawking radiation more than compensates for the loss in area, so the generalized second law still holds. And generalized second law, in a more general setup, not just Hawking evaporation, was proved in 2011 in a very precise form, and has a very non-trivial and interesting proof that follows from causality, so it seems like it's a very deep fact. And classical focusing has also been conjectured to be replaced by quantum focusing conjecture. And there's, like I said, there's a lot of evidence for quantum focusing conjecture, mostly through the fact that the quantum focusing conjecture predicts a new energy condition in quantum field theory called the quantum null energy condition. And the quantum null energy condition has been proven in many different ways in recent years. So quantum focusing conjecture is just a statement that, so if classical focusing was just that area sort of do this, area rate of area growth, sort of area has a negative acceleration, let's say. This just says that the generalized entropy has negative acceleration. So areas could anti-focus as long as the entropy focusing more than compensates for the area anti-focusing. And many things, so I'm putting a few of them here, and there are a lot of people responsible for these developments. But the general idea is that if you take area over 4 GH bar and whatever you thought was true of that quantity, if you replace it by generalized entropy, in many cases, you restore your condition or your expectations that you had for area, even in presence of quantum matter. So back here to the definition of where a black hole is. I defined it in the early slides by the condition that the classical expansion of a surface is zero. When the classical expansion was zero, I marked that point, called it a marginally trapped surface. Boom, that's where my black hole is. Now I'm going to replace the notion of classical expansion by quantum expansion, where instead of just looking at how my area changes as I move the surface in a given direction, I look at how the generalized entropy changes. So I take into account the entropy variations of the matter fields outside as I move my surface out or inwards. So with that, I can define an analog of, basically I can define a quantity called the quantum expansion, which is basically the classical expansion theta k plus 4 GH bar times null derivatives of von Neumann entropy. And by setting that equal to zero, I can define what's called a quantum marginally trapped surface. So now I'm going to upgrade my definition of where a black hole is to quantum marginally trapped surfaces as opposed to classical marginally trapped surfaces. So there are several nice things about quantum marginally trapped surfaces. First of all, the idea that a classical marginally trapped surface has to be behind an event horizon is violated quantum mechanically. In an evaporating black hole, classical marginally trapped surfaces lie outside of the event horizon. So even if you thought that classically you were stuck behind an event horizon because you were sort of momentarily doomed in growing your area, you still can escape from the singularity. But quantum marginally trapped surfaces will definitely have to be behind the event horizons, even if event horizons exist. And that's quantum, that's Aaron Wald proved this, quantum singularity theorems, I think is the name of the paper. And the interesting thing is that I get back my generalized second law for local definitions of a black hole. If I just follow along these quantum marginally trapped surfaces and say, well, here's where my black hole is, the generalized entropy of these slices grow as I move upwards. This was proven by Busso and Engelhardt. I just remember one thing that I skipped when I defined this notion of coarse grain entropy is that once you define coarse grain entropy by the maximum area of X I can put behind mu holding the outer wedge fixed, then the area law of this classically marginally trapped surface follows just from the fact that the outer wedges that I'll be fixing as I go to the future of the black hole are getting smaller and smaller. So if I'm maximizing some quantity subject to holding the outer wedge fixed, but the outer wedges are getting nested, it means that I get to maximize the area more. So then the fact that the area of a black hole gets larger is just a consequence of my coarse graining getting coarser. Is that clear? That's an important thing. I'm going backwards. So now the generalized entropy, now the generalized second law of these marginally trapped surfaces demands an explanation in terms of a coarse grain entropy. Because I would expect a coarse grain entropy to satisfy something like the second law. So it's interestingly, even though the generalized entropy contains areas plus a Feynman entropy, and the Feynman entropy of matter fields is a fine-grained quantity, the combination of these two things still behaves like a thermodynamic entropy, which I think is a deep fact of quantum gravity. So the problem I'm going to formulate here and then try to solve is, it's an exact analogous problem to the area case. Given a quantum marginally trapped surface, can I interpret the generalized entropy of this surface mu as the following problem? If I hold the outer wedge fixed to this quantum marginally trapped surface, what is the surface, what is a surface I can put in behind it with the largest, what is the largest quantum extremal surface I can put in behind this region? And by largest, I mean largest value of generalized entropy. And that is because the Ryu Takinagi prescription that previously I used to argue that area of a classical extremal surface is equal to a Feynman entropy, that also gets upgraded under quantum corrections to becoming the entropy on the boundary is computed by the generalized entropy of a quantum extremal surface in the box. So that's a correction on top of the classical state. So this, in short, is the problem, this is the question I'm asking. Maximum generalized entropy of X, where X is quantum extremal surface, subject to holding the outer wedge fixed. This is the problem. Is there any questions? So to answer this question, I'm going to take a side to a seemingly different problem in quantum field theory. Oh, I should first say that the generalized second law is the most non-trivial when you're talking about excitations that are applied to a black hole, about quantum perturbations to a stationary black hole. Because if the black hole is already, is being classically enlarged due to collapse of some classical matter on top of it, the area growth is going to overwhelm the Feynman entropy changes because the area has a 1 over 4GH bar that enhances it. So the problem of the generalized, the discrepancy between the generalized entropy of a quantum marginally trapped surface and its area is most interesting when you're talking about, you have a killing horizon and you're talking about small perturbations on that killing horizon, where the quantum marginally trapped surface and the classical marginally trapped surface are very close by, and one of them is violating the area law, the other one is satisfying the generalized second law. So then you can really separate these two problems and say, well, why is it that the generalized entropy works even though the area fails to satisfy the second law properties and things like that? So if with that, I'm going to basically reduce this problem to a perturbations to a killing horizon, where basically I think of any deviations of the geometry as some sort of linearized fields expanded on my killing horizon. So now with that, I'm going to take you to the quantum field theory aside. So there's a thought experiment formulated by Aaron Wall that we took and analyzed further and found something very interesting and not surprising that happened to exactly help us with answering the previous question. So this is a problem purely in quantum field theory. Let's say you have a killing horizon, like a killing horizon along K, that's your L direction, and this is the side, the different view of the same killing horizon. And I have some cut mu marked by this green region that separates my space-time into two regions, the left wedge and the right wedge. And I have some density matrix in the right wedge that I'm holding fixed. That's called rho of R. I'm going to not change the density matrix on the right side, but I'm going to ask the question of what is the minimum possible energy I can put in the left side of my space that's consistent with my knowledge that the density matrix in the right side of the space-time is known. So basically, the knowledge of my quantum state on the right basically limits my ability to put whatever state I want on the left, and my question is, how can I minimize the total amount of energy I can put on the left? And by total amount of energy, I mean pick some null parameter, null affine parameter V, moving down from the surface mu along n minus k, and sum up the energy in the form of like integral of dv tkk along each of these rays, and then sum them up all in the transverse direction y. That marks basically where mu goes. So this is a similar problem. This is a seemingly different problem in quantum field theory, and I'm going to analyze it. But to analyze it, I need to introduce the notion of the concept of relative entropy. So relative entropy is basically a quantum information object, which basically, given two density matrices, relative entropy between them is given by this. And this has had a lot of applications in quantum field theory, mostly due to Cassini and others that really applied it and found interesting quantum field theory facts from this. So the reason that this quantity, relative entropy, is a very natural quantity to study in quantum field theory is because for exactly these setups where I have a null plane and I have this some cut of this null plane, and therefore my region basically is defined by the region below this null cut or above this null cut. For these surfaces, if I compare the relative entropy of whatever state I have in the lower side or in the left side in this picture to the vacuum state in that same place, this relative entropy becomes equal to the boost energy in this region minus the Fenoyman entropy of this region. This is really the vacuum subtracted Fenoyman entropy, but that doesn't matter really here. And the boost energy is basically, instead of computing dvTvv, you compute like dvvTvv on each of these null rays, and then you add them up together in the y direction. So relative entropy is the boost energy minus the Fenoyman entropy of the left. So in that sense, this relative entropy gives me access to both energy and Fenoyman entropy in some sort of one package form as relative entropy. And relative entropy has some very interesting properties that becomes useful here, which first property is just that it's non-negative. It's a notion of distance between two states, so it's always a non-negative quantity. And that it, because it's a notion of distinguishability between two density matrices, if I, for example, have the relative entropy between my state here and between the vacuum here, and if I enlarge my region a little bit, which gets formalized into this functional derivative that I can take with respect to moving my cut V up, this functional derivative has to be non-negative because I've learned more about the differences between rho and sigma. So it's from information theoretically, just the statement that the CPTP map acted on rho and sigma would reduce my relative entropy. So the opposite of it, if I learn more information, my relative entropy gets larger. And interestingly, when you take this functional derivative, relative entropy with the functional derivative evaluated at this point y, let's say, becomes a statement about the energy integrated, TKK energy integrated only on this null line minus the changes of the Fenoyman entropy subject to the formation of my region in this at this position y along in the null direction. So this functional derivative is also non-negative. And also a third interesting fact about relative entropy that doesn't have an information theoretic interpretation yet, but it's true, is that the second functional derivative of relative entropy is also non-negative, subject to two different null deformations. And this is called the quantum null energy condition. It has various proofs, but I'm just gonna take it to be true. I can't really give an intuitive understanding of why it's true. So interestingly, this bound, and from now on, without loss of generality, just simplify my life here, I'm going to assume that the state, the global state, is a pure state. So look at this inequality here. The energy on the lower side, if the state is pure, the energy of the lower side is lower bounded by the Fenoyman entropy by the functional derivative of the Fenoyman entropy of the right side. And this is really without loss of generality, because even if the state was mixed, this would have been true, this inequality. So that's an interesting thing, because basically it's telling me that knowing the state on the right side, and therefore knowing the deformation of the Fenoyman entropy subject to null variations of the right wedge, actually bounds, lower bounds, the amount of negative energy, but the amount of energy I could have on this red region. This just bounds follows from monotonicity of relative entropy. So if I really want to do my best in minimizing the energy, I need to saturate this bound. I need to get the energy as low as this bound lets me. So I'm going to set this to equal. And of course, when I put this equal, I'm basically saying that the monotonicity of relative entropy subject to a null deformation here is zero, because this bound was basically the monotonicity of relative entropy, and saturating it means saturating this inequality. And similarly, if I want to minimize the energy everywhere in the lower side, this has to be true for every point in this cut. So my monotonicity of relative entropy is saturated momentarily at every, subject to every null deformation around my original cut mu. So this has drastic consequences for the quantum state that I put in the lower side. So given that the first derivative in the k direction of relative entropy is zero on mu, and the fact that generally I know that the first derivative of relative entropy and its second derivative has to be non-negative, just as a rule, always. This means that, subject to some smoothness assumption and stuff that I can relax, is basically says that I have some function relative entropy that has a derivative equal to zero at some cut mu. And if I go to lower cuts, let's say this is my v direction, if I go to lower cuts, relative entropy can't do this because it would violate the second line. It can't go down because it would violate the third line. So basically it's constrained to just follow along this, it's basically has to flat line. So this condition, the fact that relative entropy doesn't change momentarily subject to deformations here, and this is the relative entropy between this state, whatever this energy minimizing state is, and the vacuum. The fact that relative entropy doesn't change momentarily as I move the cut downwards suggests that relative entropy doesn't change ever as I keep moving the slice down. And this has drastic consequences, because what it means is that as I move my cut up further and further, sort of like how it is in this picture, if I move my cut further and further, in this new region that I see, I don't learn anything new about how this state is different from the vacuum. And what that means is that any observable in that region, in this energy minimizing state, has to be exactly consistent with the vacuum being there. So that region is, this region, this sliver here, is basically in the vacuum. Is that clear? I see some.
Did you say relative entropy is constant for deformations in both directions, or one of the,
Well, the first derivative of relative entropy subject to moving in the k direction is zero all the way up to the surface mu. Past it, then I have my right side density matrix, whatever it is. But before it, the place where I'm guessing my state, yeah, and relative entropy of the left sides always. Left sides as I sort of see more and get closer and closer to mu. Relative entropy cannot change. So the fact that the state has to be vacuum in those regions in particular implies that the stress energy tensor on n minus k, TKK, has to be zero. And TKK being zero, together with this equality, tells me that the Neumann entropy of the right side, subject to moving my anchor point up and down here, so these are relative entropies of these right sides, as I move my cut up, the relative entropy doesn't change. Because the relative entropy is, by definition of these states being energy minimizing, is equal to the integral of TKK down n minus k. So these two are among the more interesting conditions that these states are supposed to satisfy. So then you could look at this and say, wait a minute, where did the energy go? I was supposed to have this much energy in the lower side, but then you're telling me TKK is zero. So what happened? We were led to conclude that the energy, all of the energy, has to be stored right at the transition point in the form of a delta function. of the value given by functional derivative of phenomenal entropy of the right side evaluated at mu. So this was our conclusion from these states, and I'm going to tell you why it's interesting, why these states are interesting for the previous problem. But while we were doing this independently, Tom Faulkner, for a different purpose, actually constructed states in quantum field theory that do exactly this. It's actually a little better. So the way he constructed these states was he took given some state psi, where I have some right region and I have left region, and I want to hold my right region fixed, he introduced a unitary transformation, or at least used something that was known before, I think, as Kant's cocyclical flow, which basically is defined as a flow generated under a unitary that purely acts on the left side. And the unitary is basically a combination of the density matrix of the left in the state psi to the power is, with the density matrix of the vacuum on the left side to the power minus is. So it's like a modular flow with respect to the state, and then a reverse modular flow with respect to the vacuum. And an interesting feature of this state is that, so if you did either one of these by themselves, this will, those of you who know, modular flow sort of close to the entangling surface looks like a boost. And if you act with a boost on all the Rindler modes that form the vacuum, you're going to destroy the vacuum, and you're going to create infinite energy at the junction, at the entangling surface. So what this does is that the combination of these two, it restores the vacuum. So you're not destroying the vacuum at the entangling surface, but what you are doing still, you can show that in the state given by psi s under this flow, what you're doing is that you're taking all observables, all endpoint functions on this wedge, and you're effectively boosting their values. So all observables restricted fully to the left side get boosted. Observables purely restricted to the right side won't get changed. And relational observables, like an endpoint function with some points there and some points here, they go to some crazy thing that is highly theory dependent. You can't just kinematically evaluate it. But nevertheless, you can analyze the properties of these states. So first of all, the fact that the one-sided observables just get boosted, in particular, implies that TKK on this slide will just go to the TKK on the state before the boost by some sort of damp factor e to the minus 2s. Sort of your washing away energy on this n minus k surface by boosting it down. And you also can show that the phenomenon entropy of these right regions, as I move my anchor up and down here, the k derivative of that phenomenon entropy in the state psi s gets a damped sort of factor compared to what it was before. So then, and right away, and another interesting feature is that right away, as you turn on this flow S, you get a shock at the junction on the slice mu with a value given by this. So which is the phenomenon entropy variation at the slice mu, but there's a 1 minus e to the minus S. So if you take the S goes to infinity of this, you get exactly the states that we expected. That TKK is 0, DKSR is 0, and there is a shock exactly as we predicted from our general analysis of this state sitting at the entangling surface mu. Now you could at that point say, well, we had a more general argument, so any energy minimizing state has to have these properties. Or you could just say, well, maybe these are all that there are. There's no other way of making an energy minimizing state that's not this. I don't know the answer to that, but at least there is one, and more generally, we know that any energy minimizing state has to have these features that I wrote down because of our more general argument. Okay, so now, are there any questions here? I'm going to quickly go back to the perturbative setup of the coarse graining question. So remember, the coarse graining question was, how can I find a quantum extremal surface with the maximum generalized entropy that I can put behind the surface mu? So as I said, I reduced the problem before in terms of how interesting it would be to perturbations around the Killing horizon. So now I can juxtapose that problem to the quantum field theory problem that I was studying before and say, well, I don't know about this problem, but let's just put in the energy minimizing states on n minus k. Let's just do it. And if you do that, you will get a shock marked by this red stuff that's going to be of this magnitude, h bar over 2 pi dks, sitting as a delta function there. And remember, the slice mu was a quantum marginally trapped surface. So a quantum marginally trapped surface means that its classical expansion is not zero, but it's equal to minus 4g h bar dks, where dk of s is the fundamental entropy change in the k direction. So by Ray Chidori equation, which sort of tells me how theta k changes in the k direction, I know, so there is a term in the Ray Chidori equation, which is basically the TKK, the null-null component of the stress tensor. And it's exactly the amount that this energy minimizing states have that would set the expansion on n minus k to zero. So these states, so this is still very surprising to me that somehow these two problems knew about each other. It's probably not that surprising once you really understand the whole story, but right now it seems like a miracle. I had just enough shock to set the classical expansion to zero on n minus k because of Ray Chidori equation. And also I knew independently that these states have the property that dk of s is equal to zero. So put them together, you have quantum expansion as well as classical expansion zero on n minus k. And the story about finding the quantum extremal surface is not that different from before. I've now found a surface which is quantum stationary in the k direction, theta k is zero. And theta L will be close to the dk of theta L would be close to the negative value it had before. So it's going to blast through some zero somewhere. So I can find some place where it's quantum extremal. And its generalized entropy, by definition of this being quantum stationary, is equal to the generalized entropy of the surface mu. So here we go. I'm done. I've argued that the coarse-grained entropy, that the generalized entropy of a quantum marginally trapped surface is, in a real sense, a coarse-grained entropy, in the sense of holding the outer wedge fixed and maximizing generalized entropy of the quantum extremal surface. So now, so this was for the perturbative case, where the excitations that I'm introducing to my black hole are some quantum excitations, some order h bar excitations, where I argued that that's where the generalized second law is most pressing, sort of, because it doesn't follow just from the classical area law of dynamical horizons. But in general, we might want to, you know, fantasize about having a prescription that assigns the generalized entropy of a quantum marginally trapped surface mu in, as it's going through some very dynamical phase. We might want to assign a generalized entropy, we might want to interpret the generalized entropy of it still as some sort of coarse-grained entropy subject to holding the outer wedge fixed. So we have a proposal for how you would do this, and we don't prove it, we just propose it, and I'm going to just give you some motivation after this slide for why we think that should work. So first of all, let's go back to the Engelhard-Wald construction, where they attached, their coarse-grained prescription was, they just took the surface mu and attached a stationary null hypersurface behind it. Motivated by the Kant's co-cycle flow, we basically realized that you can get this stationary null hypersurface as a limit through a sequence of geometries, where in the original geometry, I had some, very crazy looking n minus k that, you know, maybe the shell was falling in and it did all kinds of things to this null surface. But I can define an affine parameter v downwards, and then I can find this surface orthogonal surface codimension two slices, and then I just do this to the geometry, v times e to the s, where I take the intrinsic geometry of all these slices and I add some slice v, and I just put that at v times e to the s instead. So this is sort of you can think of a generalization of a boost that you can always define on a null hypersurface. So that in particular will dampen my expansions on this surface, according to this formula, and also dampen my shear on this surface. and in the S goes to infinity limit. So these are a family of geometries I could introduce, and note that because the expansion was zero, I don't have to worry about my constraint equation not being satisfied across this junction, because the most important constraint equation turns out to be just the Reicha-Durie equation, which tells me that the changes of theta k, not every change of theta k is allowed. But if the surface was a quantum marginally, well, it was a classically marginally trapped surface, theta k would be zero. So before and after this S flow, my jump in theta k would still be zero. So if theta k wasn't zero, then it would be damped on one side and not changed on the other side. So I'll go from zero to some positive or negative value, and the Reicha-Durie equations would be constrain that, and in some cases not allow that. But this construction is particularly nice for classically trapped, classically marginally trapped surfaces. Which, so this stretching, basically I'm straightening this geometry out by stretching it. So theta k and sigma k get damped in this way. So in the S goes to infinity limit, I recover the Engelhardt wall construction of attaching a null stationary surface where I can just move down this surface and find a classically trapped surface. So our quantum, classically extremal surface. So thinking of this, then our quantum, what I said here is not very speculative. This is just a construction. You can define this family of geometries. This is our quantum conjecture, that not only you do this to the classical geometry, you also do this to the quantum state, meaning that if I define some observables in terms of endpoint functions on these null rays, the endpoint function will just go in the canonical way to another endpoint function after the boost, it's not really, it's a generalization of boost, but after this stretching. But in particular, the property that I care about the most is that the quantum expansion, as well as the classical expansion that was damped before, as I argued, the quantum expansion along the k direction is also going to be damped, so that in the S goes to infinity, the quantum expansion approaches zero, and the fact that you had a quantum marginally trapped surface, and then you suddenly jump to a stationary surface, which means that you went from some theta k that was like order h bar suddenly to zero, again requires this negative, or some whatever energy that I had before and I derived before. Here I would just be positing that this energy exists in this family of states. So now I have one last slide to motivate why this, right now at face value it just seems like, well, this is some random thing, I'm just wishful thinking maybe. But I'm gonna give one application of this, which I'm gonna end with some discussion, with some summary or something. So this is a work in progress with Rafael Venn, and also Pratik Rath is working on this. So this is the application of these flowed geometries that I defined. This is just at the classical level, actually, in ADS-CFT. So this is a setup where I'm interested in how changing this geometry will affect the boundary CFT. So I have this ADS-CFT setup. I have a left region and a right region on my boundary in the Poincaré patch that in the bulk are sort of separated into two regions marked by the RT surface that emanates from this point, which is this green surface mu. So now I can apply this construction of stretching the geometry in the n minus k in the bulk. I can take the slices here and I can just boost their geometry down with basically effectively with this prescription. And in particular, this would have the consequence that theta k would get damped and sigma k would get damped. Now, as I said before, theta k, because theta k is zero by the definition of that surface being quantum, being classical extremal, there is going to be no sudden jump in theta k before and after as I do the stretching under some parameter flow s. So this jump is zero. But sigma didn't have to be zero before. So if I do this damping and my shear goes from whatever it was before to e to the minus s times that value, it means that right before and right after the surface mu, I'm going to have a sudden jump in sigma k, sigma is the shear, which is given by 1 minus e to the, this was, should have been an e to the minus s times the value of sigma k on mu, whatever value it had originally. And there is an analog of the Ray-Chiodur equation, which tells me how my shear in the k direction changes as I move my surface in the k direction. And instead of that being fed by TKK, it's fed by components of the Weyl tensor on the background. So in particular here, if z is the emergent gravity direction in ADS CFD, I'm in particular interested in this particular component of this shear focusing equation or something, which is the zz component of this, which gets related to c kz kz component of the Weyl tensor. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this stretching that I just defined in the bulk, what it does is that it demands by this equation that my sigma kzz jump is supported by a Weyl shock, by a shock in the CKZ, KZ component of the Weyl metric. And you can further show that CKZ, KZ in the bulk, in the near boundary regime, becomes related to the TKK component of the stress tensor on the boundary. It's very intuitive. That's sort of like, Weyl tensor is sort of like the strength of the gravity field, and it becomes related to the stress tensor on the boundary, but you can show this exactly. And further, and this is kind of was a little new to us, is that the shear of the RT surface, its ZZ component, the shear in the K direction, becomes related to the changes of the Feynman entropy on the boundary as I move my entangling surface on the boundary in the V direction. So as I move my surface, this is the boundary now, I move my entangling surface up here. So these two equalities means that when I put these together, these stretch geometries induce a shock on the boundary exactly as predicted by this Kahn's co-cycle flow. And what this means is that, I mean, we have to check more things to be sure of this, is that there are really good candidates to be the bulk dual of a boundary Kahn's co-cycle flow. So a boundary Kahn's co-cycle flow is an effective one-sided boost, and in the bulk, no matter how messed up this geometry is, you find the RT surface and you do the stretching on one side of it. And that's the dual. And now the question is, what I stated before about the quantum generalization of this seems to me the only natural sort of FLM corrections to this construction, if I want to include now the bulk quantum corrections to the boundary Kahn's co-cycle flow, this probably would be the only thing I can write down that's consistent. But anyways, at least this, so far we have shown that this construction that seemed random from this point of view has a very natural boundary interpretation in terms of the boundary Kahn's co-cycle flow. And this is a work in progress, and I'll keep you updated. So I think I might, I'm good. Any questions before I summarize? Okay, so in summary, we understood the generalized entropy of black holes, and what I mean by that, quantum generalized entropy of quantum marginally trapped surfaces as a coarse grain entropy in a very specific way by a specific construction, which explains from a microscopic point of view why they satisfy a generalized second law. Again, the same explanation. The wedges are getting smaller, so I'm coarse graining more and more. Therefore, if I coarse grain more and more, my Feynman entropy just gets large. So, and also proposed a non-perturbative, and by non-perturbative here, I don't mean non-perturbative in GH bar, I just mean non-perturbative in amplitude, where, you know, I don't necessarily require a near stationarity of my space-time or near killing horizonness of the black hole. Proposed a non-perturbative construction even to interpret the generalized entropy of quantum margin trap surfaces in those regimes as coarse grain entropies. And that construction seems to have a very natural boundary dual. So it seems to us that it's on the right track. And just I'm going to say two future directions. So this future direction is a little unrelated, but it's something that's really interesting to me, which is to understand in what sense the generalized entropy of event horizons or causal horizons that did not enter this construction where we were doing at all. Our construction was heavily reliant on the definition of the black hole being the local one, not the global one, a la the causal horizon or event horizon. construction. Understand microscopically what the generalized entropy of an event horizon means, because that also satisfies all the first law looking and second law looking equations, with the entropy being played by the by area over 4GH bar. And we don't have an understanding of where it comes from a microscopic point of view. And I don't know what that means. That means probably that we haven't either found it, or if there is no interpretation, that seems to be then a very big coincidence why it satisfies all these entropic conditions, the event horizon does. And about this construction, I can say a few words about how it's related to, I mean, so we are hopeful that understanding better this relation between the boundary Kunskal cycle flow and this bulk flow whereby you change the geometry and the state at the same time by stretching them both together, could shed light on a non-perturbative understanding of the JLMS formula. So the JLMS formula is just sort of the roughly the equality between the modular flow on the boundary and the modular flow in the bulk. But it's only rigorous or formulated in its current form when in the bulk you're not interested in states that have drastically different geometry from your original state. So it's about perturbations around your original geometry. But this construction that I talked about here involves a drastic change of the geometry. This, as it pertains to the relation between the two geometries, there's a drastic change. But it still seems like some duality holds. So maybe the nice thing to generalize JLMS to the non-perturbative regime is to go with the Kunskal cycle flow and not with the modular flows independently. But that's still something under construction we are thinking about. Okay, I'm gonna stop here. Thank you.
All right, we have time for a couple questions. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Set the notion within the horizon, and apart from the radial change of the black hole, it will correspond to the transverse direction of metric change that's angle dependent, that's so-called like the black hole memory effect. Mm-hmm. And then in your picture, how does this minimize energy state change?
So you're interested in first throwing this angle dependent shockwave, and then looking at a black hole slices to the future of that?
Yeah, so like for the black hole, that corresponds to a super translation on the horizon, and I'm wondering how that corresponds to
So I think this stretching of the geometry, what it does to this shock, that due to this angle dependent super translation, is that let's say if there was some energy, since this was formed by some matter, let's say, it would basically take that energy and boost it away, and basically dilute the energy in the k direction by basically doing this boost construction. So I would say that effectively in the s goes to infinity limit of this construction, the details of the shock will go away, and only it will imprint in terms of a change that it has on the area or something. Only that information will survive, which is enough for me, because that's all the coarse grain. The coarse grain entropy only cares about the area and not the details of what formed the black hole. So this stretching will forget that and keep only the memory about the area increase, I would say, that shock has caused. But these things that you're talking about also are defined on the event horizon, right?
Yeah,
so that might be a little problematic here, because this construction is really best suited for marginally trapped surfaces, which could deviate from horizons drastically. Couldn't be nowhere near each other. So, but if they were close, I would expect something like I said to be effectively what's happening.
Any other questions? Maybe just a quick one. You said this sigma is KZZ is given by the change in the entropy on the boundary here, this formula right here?
Yeah. Sorry.
Do you use RT to determine that, or Are you doing something else?
This formula, this sigma, this one?
Yeah.
That's right.
So it's just
you use RT in a sense that sigma, the sigma of the RT surface is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I'm just wondering how you got
that. Yeah. So using RT, basically.
Okay. Any other questions?
Sorry, there was
a
hand.
Small seeds.
Yeah, near boundary. That's right. Yeah, you Pfefferman Graham these guys. You see that the leading term is sort of related to the STV on the boundary.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.
Okay.